Mishpatim, the
favorite. Right, Mishpatim, that's right, that's the center. Would you like, sure? Okay, so Mishpatim, that's the Sedra this week, Mishpatim, and it's also Parshat Shkalim. And very often, the Maimah of the Rebbe, when it was Parshat Shkalim, would be on the theme of Shkalim. But for whatever reason, I chose a discourse where it was actually Adar Rishon, and so it wasn't Parshat Shkalim. And so this is actually about the text and the theme of the opening of the parsha. We're going to be looking at a discourse, a maimo, which was said in Tavshin Lamed Chet, 1978, and it was said Motzei Shabbat, after Shabbat, from the Rebbe's room. And it was over the loudspeaker in 770 and over the phone around the world. And I probably heard it then at that time. And at about 2 o'clock in the morning or something in London at the Babbage House. Since they came at that time of night, it was usually easy to come and hear them. Whereas if they'd have been at 9 o'clock, it would have been more difficult because I would have been here or somewhere else. But 2 o'clock in the morning, one can always manage with the help of God. So ve'ela hamishpatim asher tasim lifneim. These are the judgments, the laws which you should put before them. Hashem says, ki tikne eved ivri, when you buy a Hebrew slave. Sheishanim Yavod. Now, whether it's a Hebrew slave or is it Avdoshel Ivri, is it the slave of a Hebrew? You see, that's a question that Rashi raises in discussing this pasuk. He comes out with the idea, the final conclusion, that it means a Hebrew slave. And the proof.
Surely Jews should not keep slaves or deal in, I know they did, but in a slave trade after being themselves slaves. But surely Judaism as well.
Yeah. But here we're talking about the slave in the Torah, which there's a sense in which once you enter the Torah Psukim, you are entering a kind of a different world. Where, on the one hand, there is the reality of the law as it applies to, let's say, business dealings or something like that. But on the other hand, there are many things which are very remote from Jewish daily life for many centuries. They did, in fact, have Canaanite slaves in the time of the Mishnah. And there are famous incidents like Rabban Gamliel, who had a slave, and one day, well, that was an earlier stage.
Is it slave or worker?
Well, this was actually a slave, and the nature of a slave of a Jew in this form is that as a male slave, he's circumcised, and he has to keep Jewish law to the extent of that a woman has to keep Jewish law. So in other words, he has to keep all the negative commandments and the positive commandments not affected by time. So he doesn't put on tefillin, but he does have to keep Shabbat. And then if the slave is freed, he becomes a full Jew. So the story goes in the Mishnah that once there were just 9 people, they needed a 10th person for the minyan. So Akiva, do you remember what happened? What happened?
The slave became a Jew.
That's right. He freed the slave and the slave became a Jew, and in that way they had a minion. Given the price of slaves, it was an expensive minion. So there is...
Was a female slave?
There were female slaves, although I'm not sure if at that stage they had them anymore. The institution of the Hebrew slave, and the female slave is also a female Hebrew slave, There could be. Oh, well, that would be if it was a female Canaanite slave, a female non-Jewish slave. Yes, that would be the same thing. That would be the same thing. But there was also a completely different institution relating to Jews. And it was really a form of what happens when someone is bankrupt, that they would sell themselves into a kind of slavery,
bondage.
Into bondage for 7 years. Yeah, it's like you sign a contract for 7 years and there you are. And so that would give him
a beck and call, man or woman.
That's right. And you'd be in this position, and after 7 years you would be freed. And also if the Yovel, if the Jubilee year came along in the middle, you would get freed. So there were a number of...
So if you were cunning, you'd just go towards the end of the sixth year.
Yeah, but if they... Well, no, the end of the Yovel year.
Yeah.
The 6 years counts from when you start, from when the person starts being a slave, an Eved. But they would know when it is till the Yovel, and the price would probably
vary
according to that. Then there was another institution where a destitute father would sell his daughter it's more like being a maidservant with the hope that she will either marry the boss or the boss's son.
And if she doesn't, if they
don't want to marry her, then as soon as she reaches puberty, she goes free. So in other words, this is a way of selling, let's say, a seven-year-old girl, that she becomes a maidservant in someone's house. I'm not recommending this as a procedure, but this is how it works in the Mishnah and Talmud. So based on these biblical verses, she would go and work in someone's house and ideally would marry either the master or the master's son, and she would be a normal wife as such. She wouldn't have any less.
So at 14 she could marry, you know, the 90-year-old widow.
Well,
or could he take more than one wife in those days?
Well, in those days people did have, that was before the cherem of Rabbeinu Gershom, and people did have more than one wife. That's sometimes. I mean, the Mishnah says in order to have more than one wife, you have to have a separate house for each wife.
It's so very African tribal.
But why do they have to keep as the slave has to keep it only as much as the women have to keep? Because they're so busy that they can't keep the rest? Or is that just to show that the position of women is difficult?
Is it telling us something about a slave or about a woman? The mystical reasons for that might be completely different. On one level, you could say, you could look at a sort of a practical reason, which maybe is the same, is that their time is not their own. As is well known, that a wife, a woman, a mother, is at the behest of her children, not to mention a husband occasionally. And so
I thought that according to the Shulchan Aruch, he is also at her behest.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
But according to some responsive that some friends of mine got
and
sent out on the email circuit, that basically some of the Gedolim of today said that in fact we're obligated to just the same as men, and we'll pay for it that we don't.
We'll pay
like for davening, like davening three times a day and that sort of thing, davening gam betzibur.
And so what are they saying on this
email? So basically that we'll be paying, that in Olam Haba we'll be paying for the fact we haven't davened betzibur three times a day.
I don't know where that comes.
Where did you hear that?
Oh, it was an email that was circulated to me probably when my kids were about two, that we should be careful of being lenient with oneself over such things, because because according to this response we were just as obligated as men, and therefore the fact that in a lot of shtiebels there's no place for women to daven on a daily basis, and perhaps it's about time we made some noise about it and not, you know, not carried on sort of davening in the street because there's no one in the shtiebel.
Judith wants to come and daven.
No.
All right, the minions at 7 o'clock. And we can organise. We'll organise them.
Do you need a minion of woman?
That we didn't go into.
I think things have to change.
You know when they talk about. I
don't think they were in
original.
Yeah.
Why isn't Shabbat there?
Because there is a whole business.
A specific time when you can't do certain
what's
things.
What's in?
Can't do
no, Mitzvah Shahas Mangrama means positive Mitzvah. Shahas Mangrama.
Which way are you?
So, I mean, Shabbat, all the negative Mitzvah of Shabbat are negative Mitzvah where it's it doesn't make any difference whether it's affected by time or not. And then, since, I think, for example, with Pesach, you've got the prohibition on eating chametz, and you've got the positive mitzvah of eating matzah on the night of the Seder. So the Gemara and the Shulchan Aruch say, anyone who is governed by the law of not eating chametz has also got the law that they should eat matzah on the night of the Seder. So even though eating matzah at the night of the Seder is a positive mitzvah affected by time, women are still included in it, because they are affected by the law of not eating chametz. So they eat matzah on the night of the Seder as a positive command, even though it's as a positive command which directly affects them, even though it is governed by time. The blowing of the shofar doesn't have exactly the same rationale, and it's described, it's also a positive mitzvah affected by time, and it's stated in the commentaries on the Code of Law that women, or on the Code of Law itself, that women accepted this on them. And so therefore, not only do women hear the shofar blown, but a man is allowed to blow the shofar even if the only people listening are women. Because it's something precious to them which they accepted on themselves, even though it's actually going beyond the letter of the law, which is that a positive mitzvah affected by time does not apply to them. There's a further dimension of the whole idea of the feminine and the source of the time. The feminine relates to the Sphira Malchut, and the Sphira Malchut is the source of time, and so therefore the feminine is beyond those mitzvot affected by time. So being the source of time, that puts her beyond those mitzvah. So that mystical reason does not apply to the slave, the Canaanite slave. So here we have the idea that when you get ki tikneh bedivri, when you acquire a Hebrew slave, sheishanim yavod, for 6 years he should work, uvashviit, and in the 7th year yetzei lachofshi chinam, he should go free. Incidentally, there is another reason why the Hebrew slave might be sold, which is that he was a robber. He stole a lot of money, and as a result of that, he has to pay it back, and he hasn't got it. He spent it, or he stole cattle or something, and he slaughtered them, and he's got to pay back not just the amount that he stole, he's got to pay back double or more. And so because he doesn't have the money, he is sold into a kind of slavery for 6 years, and that money is used to pay the person that he owes the money to. So if he came alone, right, in the 7th year he should go out free. Im begapo yavo begapo yetze. If he came unmarried as a slave, he should go out unmarried. Im balishohu, if he was the husband of a wife, v'yatza ishto imo, his wife should go free with him. Now Rashi says, what does it mean she should go free with him? She was never enslaved. But this tells us that if you buy, as a master, you buy a Hebrew slave, and he's married, you have to provide money for his wife. You have to look after his wife. And so now that he's going free, his wife goes free with him.
So you're saying she was a slave as well?
No, she didn't. She wasn't working as a slave, but just she has.
So you're saying go free. So go free implies that the person wasn't free.
But they always become Jews if they go free.
No, here we're talking about people who were Jews at the beginning. Here it's talking about people who were Jews. It doesn't say it should go free. It says she should go out, which means that the care, her care, like she's been under the care of the master, and now she goes out from that. Her husband's gone free, and so she no longer gets lunch every day. That's she's outside that household now. She doesn't remain behind in that household. And there are various more laws about the Hebrew slave. And if we go on to the next page, verse 7, V'chi yimkor ish et bito la'ama, and if a man sells his daughter as a maid servant, here we have the Hebrew maid servant, lo teitzei ketzei tavadim, she doesn't go free in the same way as the male slave, im ra'a be'enei adoneh, if she is not good in the eyes of a master, asher lo yada, he did not marry her, v'hefta, and that would have meant freeing her, he would free her and marry her, la'am nochri lo yimshol le'mochra, b'vigdo bo, he shouldn't sell her to anyone else, v'im livno yadena, if he marries her off to his son, that's good, and k'mishpat ha'banot yasela, he should treat her like any other daughter, and im acheret yikach lo, if he takes another wife, she'erak suta v'onata lo yigra, he still has to look after her, he's allowed to take another wife, but if he does marry this girl, even though she started off as a bondswoman, nonetheless, he has to look after her by providing food and raiment and v'onata and regular marital intimacy. None of those should be decreased. V'im shloshe lelo yasela, but if he does not marry her himself or marry her to his son, or redeem her, then v'yatza chinam ein kasef, she goes free without money when she reaches puberty. So in other words, he either marries her after his son, redeems her and frees her at some earlier stage, or if he doesn't do any of that, then she goes free when she reaches puberty. So that's the rule with the maid servants. So we therefore have actually three different kinds of servant. We have a Canaanite servant, we have a Hebrew servant, and we have a maid servant. So now the discourse is going to launch these three concepts in terms of spirituality, but first of all it's going to talk a little bit about the whole concept of the Torah, because for Ela Mishpatim, these are the laws that Moshe should teach the Jewish people. Here we have in essence the whole theme of Moses teaching Torah to the Jewish people. So that's what we're going to be exploring, this discourse for Ela Mishpatim from 1978 5738. Oh, ya, ya, ba, ya, ba. Oh, ya, ba, da, ba, da, ya, ba, ba. Ya, ba, ya, ba, ya, ba, ya, ba, da. Ha, ya, ba, yo, ba, ma, yo, ba, ho. Ya, ya, da, da, ba, ya, ba, ya. Ha yere dam ba yam ba yam, ha yere dam ba yom, Yamba 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 Om bam bam bom bam bam bom Ve'eila mishpatim asher tasim lefneihem. These are the judgments which you should put before them. Umbedayik b'zeh kvod kedushat admo hazaken. And the Alter Rebbe, the first Chabad Rebbe, comments on this with Torah Or in his book Torah Or. Reish Pasha Tena, at the beginning of this Pasha, the Tzarech Lahavin, we have to understand, the Lifneihem, that you should put, these are the laws you should put before them. Mashma Lashon Rabim, that's in the plural. V'chi Tikneh, and the words when you acquire, when you buy a slave, Hulashon Yachid, is in the singular. V'hav Leilomar Ki Yiknu, it should have said, when they or you will buy in the plural. They will buy. Yiknu. Gam yadu adiyuk, also it's known the point. Mipnei ma hitchil kol ha-mishpatim b'din eved ivri. Why does it begin all the laws of the Torah with this law of the Hebrew slave? Dafka. Dezer gam kavanat ha-midrash. There's also a comment by the Midrash, and it gives an explanation. Ala pasuk, on this verse. Bomro, it says, Ani kaniti etchem b'mitzrayim. I acquired you in Egypt. And so...
Kaniti.
That's right.
Isn't that interesting?
Yes, God acquired... The word kana means both acquire and buy, like a more general kind of...
But it's also from the root ken, like a nest. Provided you with a nest.
Yes, all right. Okay.
And they hold.
So I acquired you in Egypt, and Levayetam Atchalat Ve'elam Mishpatim B'din Eved Ivri, in order to explain why this Sedra, the Ve'elam Mishpatim, all the laws should begin with the Eved Ivri, the point being that we missed out actually about what happens if the slave doesn't want to go free at the end of 7 years. And there's a special ceremony, and really there's a push that he should go free. That and God is saying, you are mine, you're not anyone else's slave, you are mine. The Jewish people belong to God, he acquired us, and so therefore we should be very wary of getting into any situation of becoming a slave. Incidentally, after the destruction of the temple, of the second temple, the Romans took many, many Jews as slaves and sold them around the Roman Empire.
Yeah.
And the most intriguing point is that very quickly these slaves gained their freedom. And there are a number of discussions why they gained it. And they became the basis of the different communities of Jews round the Mediterranean basin, round the Roman Empire. Because there are communities of Jews all the way round there, you know, whether in North Africa.
But there were communities even during the time of the Roman Empire.
There were, yes.
Elephantina was there.
That's right, yeah. And Alexandria there were. But here it scattered the Jews far around the whole, all the way round. And then from places like Sicily, they then were brought to northwestern Europe. So they, by Charlemagne.
By the way, I read today something about how a number of Jews then converted to Christianity, practically in the Byzantine period, early, very early, all over Europe. And that there are many, many converted Jewish families well preceding the Spanish Inquisition. I'll send it on to you if you are interested. It's a new piece of historical research from the Hebrew University.
So there were Jews in Spain, in Visigothic Spain, the Jews were forced to convert.
Yeah.
The Jews were forced to convert. And when the Muslims conquered Spain, they gained their freedom from the Christian Spanish. And then Spain became Muslim, and the Jews were there, and then came the Christian reconquest. But let's just focus on this issue of the Jews round the Mediterranean basin being slaves, and then they gained their freedom. So the question is why that happened, and I've heard two explanations. One is, if the Jews were keeping Shabbat and Kashrut, or trying to, it made them very inconvenient to have as slaves. You know, like, they're always full of excuses, they can't work, they can't do this, they can't do that, and that might have been a factor. But a more serious factor is, a more powerful factor probably, is the concept of Pidyan Shvuyim. There is a major mitzvah to redeem a Jewish slave. If you hear that there's a Jew who's a captive and you can redeem him or her, you should do so. And so as soon as one slave would gain freedom, he would try to get the other slaves freed as well. So it seems that very quickly these Jewish slaves gained their freedom and they became the different communities in different countries. Now, the cases of conversion to Christianity for the most part were in Visigothic Spain, which was an enforced situation. Mm-hmm. Now,
not according to this. That's really interesting.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, this study of...
But I also, just on the tour guide course, we were taught that one in four people at the time of the Roman Empire, all around the Mediterranean, were actually Jewish. And that, at the time that Christianity developed, that's still Roman. It could have easily gone the other way. If one in four people, and the other was the Mithraism, the Mithraic Islam thing, which there's there are lots of remains in Caesarea, for instance.
Uh-huh. Right.
Mithraic temples, bull worship.
Yeah, there's a Mithra temple discovered in London in around 1950 or something. Yeah. Yeah. Vainian who? Oh, sorry. All right. So in other words, we've got the basic question. The basic question is, why do all the laws which are being given? Last week, Sedra, we had the Ten Commandments. Then we had Moshe going up Mount Sinai, and then we have all these laws coming in this week's Sedra. Why does it begin with a Hebrew slave? Vainian who? And the thing is as follows: Dehine mashkot tevaeda hamishpatim megomer. What it says, these are the judgments. Huinyan klali, kamuvan. This is a general concept. These laws are something general. And we can understand this also, Mipirish Razal, what the sages explain. Shekai al klalot inyan limuda Torah. This is referring to the general idea of Torah study. So this Sedra is talking in general, or at least the beginning. It's not only a particular law. It's something general about our whole relationship with God through Torah study. V'zeh gam ke mash katov. And this is also what it says. Tasim, you should put in the singular, Lashon Yachid, the Kai al Moshe. It's speaking about Moshe. Ki inyano shel Moshe hu inyan haTorah. The whole idea, the whole theme of Moshe is the idea of the Torah. And it says that he should put the Torah ba'achar kach omer lifneihem, before them, in the plural. Hainu, that means shal yado, that through him hayta hamshachat haTorah, there was the drawing down of the Torah l'chol lechad ba'achat miYisrael, to every single Jew, ad sof kol hadorot, to the end of all generations. So Moshe is putting the Torah in front of us, is giving the Torah in front of us or before us. Ukmosh katuv zichru Torah Moshe Avdi. There's a verse in Malachi which says, remember the Torah of Moshe my servant, ad till even you have a child, the tinok, hamatchil daber, who is beginning to speak, she'aviv melamdo Torah, his father teaches him Torah. And what does he teach him? There's a tradition. What is the first verse of Torah we learn? V'hainu ha-pasuk, the verse, Torah tziva lanu Moshe. Torah was commanded to us by Moshe. That's a tradition. That's the first verse that a parent teaches their child. So all the time we've got this giving, as it were, Moshe giving the Torah to us. Ukmochen yeshna hora'a klalit b'pasuk zeh, and there's also a general instruction in this verse, gam ba'ofen limud ha'Torah, concerning how we study Torah. Shetzarich liyot ba'ofen musuyam dafke, it has to be in a particular way. As the sages explained, what does it mean, tasim lifneim, that you should put it before them? Shahamar harav shemelamed, the rabbi who is teaching, chozer b'shoneh hadavah, he says it over and over again, afilu kama pamim, many times, ad sheyavinu omek halacha b'tama heitev, until the student understands the law that he's learning properly in a clear way, and understands its meaning. Umosifod admor zakim b'zeh, and Rav Shneur Zalman, the Alter Rebbe, adds about this in his Laws of Torah study, "Tzarich ata lasim lifneim tam hamayashev talmudam umesimo belibam." When you teach Torah, you have to teach it with a reasoning which fits for their mind. It settles it in their heart. If you can explain something in such a way that it really sits and it fits in their heart, you know, now I understand it. That's the challenge for the teacher teaching Torah. He has to be able to present it in such a way that the student is really able to absorb it. So that's all learned from the word tasim, this word. These are the judgments you should put. You should put lifnehem into them, as it were, not only before them, but lipnimiyutam. The word lifne is a very interesting word.
To be internalized.
That's right, to internalize. You have to present the teachings in such a way that the individual can internalize them, absorb them within him or her, and internalize them within. So that's the general command.
Psychoanalytic interpretation.
Well, who began psychoanalytic interpretation?
Yeah,
So there we have a general concept which comes out from the beginning of the Sedra about what is Torah study and what is Torah teaching. Shezeu inyan klali b'limud ha-Torah d'chol achad ba'achat n'Yisrael. This is a general concept for learning Torah and for teaching Torah for every individual Jew, man or woman. Shehari limud ha-Torah hu mitzvah shebegufo. Study of Torah is a mitzvah of one's own body, one's own self. Shekol echad mechuyav ba'al. Each individual is duty-bound to study Torah. As it says, v'shinantam levanecha, you should teach it to your children. V'divra, and the word teach is a very interesting word. V'shinantam v'darshu razal, and the sages explain, shiyu divrei Torah shenunim u'muchudadim b'ficha. L'shanen means like to sharpen. The words of Torah should be sharpened in your mouth, and that's what it means, that the halacha should be clear. D'zeu chiyuv al kol echad v'achat Yisrael. This is a duty for every individual Jew, that they should be taught the Torah in this way. Now, when one looks in the Talmud, speaking about the laws of teaching Torah, originally it starts off that the law, the mitzvah of study of Torah and of teaching Torah is only to boys, not to girls. And then we have a number of different discussions of this in the Talmud itself, including pointing out figures like Bruria, the wife of Rabbi Meir, who was very famous for her Torah knowledge and even had a more subtle understanding than her illustrious husband in a few instances.
Didn't
she? Right, that's right. And so therefore, and I'm sure her mother was someone very special.
Yes.
And so we then have in the modern period clear instructions by great sages that women should be taught Torah, because that gives a person the inner defenses to be able, in a period of change and transition, to be able to have a sense of direction in life. So in the Talmud, in Sotah, I think it's page Kof Aleph 21, where it speaks against teaching Torah to women, the Chofetz Chaim wrote a commentary on Tractate Sotah and says nowadays this does not apply and one should teach Torah to women and girls because it is important for them to know Torah teaching in the, you know, the shifting sands of culture and society today. He was writing this at the beginning of the 20th century. And there began all kinds of movements in order to help girls study Torah. There was Beit Yaakov, which began in Krakow in Poland around 1917. And there was movements among girls in Riga in the late 1930s, where they began to study the mystical dimension of the Torah. And in Chabad, they were called the Achot HaTmimim, and they studied Sichot and Ma'amarim, discourses, like we're studying a discourse. So they studied discourses, and when Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak came to Riga, a group of these girls came to see him, and in Yechidut, and two of them said over a discourse or part of a discourse that they had been learning, and he gave them a very interesting talk, saying that now you are basically, if you reduce it to two sentences, now that you're empowered by your knowledge of Torah, you should not ridicule your parents, your mothers, and your teachers, who maybe know less than you. So you have to know that Torah gives you a strength, and you have to know how to temper that strength. So you're being empowered, but you have to use your power very carefully. And he also said that, yeah, it's a very interesting statement. And he also said you should learn halakha and like straightforward, practical and nigla Torah knowledge, revealed Torah, because ein ha'aretz chassid, you can't be call yourself a chassid and be ignorant. You have to learn some of the bread and butter, or a lot of the bread and butter of Torah as well, in order that these spiritual teachings will be the jam on the bread. But you need to have the bread in order to put the jam on the bread. So so therefore this applies to men and women, even though if you take these verses back into the Talmud, it seems to only apply to men. But nonetheless, as you come through the mediation by the sages in between, reaching our own time. And in fact, in the see, it was a very long established principle, going back at least like 1,000 years, that women must learn the halakha which applies to them. How can you expect a woman to keep Shabbat if she doesn't know the laws of Shabbat? So there was the idea of women learning halakha. In fact, in Talmudic times, according to Rabbi Shneur Zalman, in Talmudic times, women would come to the synagogue. Talking about Nicole's thing about women having a Bible shul, the women's section, they would come to the synagogue, and the rabbanim like Abaya and Rava, they would give a drasha in a language that women could understand, on the halachot of like, you know, when you were coming to a festival or
why
daily
halachot. Why should they not understand?
Well, if they were speaking Hebrew.
You mean they didn't all speak Hebrew? They
well, in Babylon, English. People spoke Aramaic.
Aramaic and Kurdish.
Yeah, well, what we see is the Aramaic of that time. And the Talmud is therefore largely, partly or largely, written in Aramaic. Mm. And in Babylonian Aramaic. The Talmud, the Babylonian Talmud is written in Babylonian Aramaic. And the
pre things that they've just discovered in Syria not just still being translated, and that the Italians are not allowed to publish. Lots of Jewish references.
There could be. Right. So
Ibla. All the Iblith stuff. Ibla.
All right. So there is the idea that women should study the halachot, which apply to them. So then came a question in 1954. The rabbi who was running the Lubavitch Seminary in Yair, near Paris, and there were Lubavitch girls, 12, 13, 15, 16, studying in this seminary, 18, and he said, he wrote to the Rebbe asking, should they study Tanya? Now, Tanya is a book of spiritual, mystical teaching. And the Rebbe wrote back and said, since there is a principle that women should study the, in order to know how to keep the laws which apply to them, and there are six continuous mitzvahs that apply to every man and woman as listed in the beginning of Sefer HaChinuch, which is a 13th century work written in Spain, and it gives a list of all the laws of the Torah, and it says at the beginning that there are six mitzvahs which are perpetual, which apply to every man and woman, such as to love God, to fear God, to recognize the unity of God, not to pray to any other being, etc. So, they're not to go astray after one's heart and one's eyes. So these mitzvot, you need to be able to be equipped to keep those mitzvot. Study of Tanya will help people be equipped to keep those mitzvot, to keep the mitzvot of loving God, of fearing God, and so on. So he said, therefore, not only is it a, it's actually a required thing. It would be absolutely right, according to the code of law, that they should study Tanya. All right, so that, so we're three lines before the end of the paragraph on the second page, page 10. So here we have the whole idea of how one should teach Torah at the beginning of our Sedra, and then it goes on to give the content of it, is really going on to tell us about the nature of the way in which a person serves God. And here's where we come to the actual concept of these different types of slave. The Canaanite slave, the Hebrew slave, and the Oma Ivriya, the Hebrew maidservant. Okay, so now these are being transformed into three levels of service of God. The slave is us, each one of us in relation to God. The question is, what kind of slave are we? Are we a Canaanite slave? Are we a Hebrew slave? Or are we the very highest madrega, the very highest level, the Hebrew maidservant? That is the highest level. Okay? So let's...
Oh, interesting.
So let's see how that moves. Okay, section Gimel. Umam shechakatuv levay pirtei avodam. And the verse goes on to explain the details of how we serve God. From the lower level to the higher level, the way in which one serves God is little by little advancing. And the beginning of the service, when you buy a Hebrew slave. Now, is it a Hebrew slave or a slave belonging to a Hebrew, a Canaanite slave? In these words are included two aspects of one's service of God. One is Bechinat Eved Knani, the Canaanite slave, and the second is the Hebrew slave. Kumuvan mimadi itaba mechilta, as we learn in the Midrash Mechilta, behuva beperush Rashi ala Torah, quoted in Rashi, in our Sedra. The Eved Ivri, the word Eved Ivri, Hainu Eved Shuhu Ivri, means a slave who is a Hebrew, Oy Eino, or perhaps Eino El Avdo Shel Ivri. It means a Canaanite slave who has been bought by a Hebrew, by a Jew. And then the Torah explains elsewhere in Parshat Re'eh that there is such a thing as a Hebrew slave, and so we apply that to our verse here. We come to the final conclusion, the sages come to the conclusion that our verse is talking about a slave who's a Hebrew. Ach mikol makom, but nonetheless, yesh no kasol kadaitach. There was a suggestion. Now, in the Talmud, there are often suggestions, and there's a principle in Hasidic thought that when the Talmud gives a suggestion, even though that's not what the final decision is, but the suggestion is also part of what the Talmud is communicating to us. See, this is a very interesting aspect of Jewish teaching, because the Talmud is full of, first of all, even the Mishnah. The Mishnah does not have just a list of the laws that we keep. It has a list of opinions of which laws we should keep, and there are different opinions very often. Rabbi Meir says this, Rabbi Yehuda says that. We have different opinions, and it ends up according to one or the other. Sometimes the Mishnah, very often the Mishnah doesn't say very clearly, and there are sort of rules to work out according to who the halacha goes. So the question is, why does the Mishnah record the rejected rule, the rejected opinion? Then in the Talmud you have discussions of all these different opinions, and the Talmud presents, what about if this, or does it mean that? And then it rejects this. It moves on to another way of looking at it. Why is that recorded in the Talmud? Why not just have all the answers, as the Rambam is? Like the Rambam is all the answers, without any of the discussion, the prior discussion. And the Hasidic response to that, I mean, there is a reason why the Rambam himself gives, why the Mishnah gives the false opinion, that if someone, the rejected opinion, that if someone comes along and says, I do it this way, which seems a bit different to what we do, we could say, oh, that is Beis Shammai's view in the Mishnah, and we don't do it that way, we do it according to Beis Hillel. So if Hanukkah, someone comes along and says, I light 8 candles on the first night of Hanukkah and 7 on the second, we can say, ah, I recognize that practice. It's mentioned in the Mishnah as being what we don't do. That's Beis Shammai's view and not Beis Hillel's view. Beis Hillel's view is that we light 1 the first night and 2 the second night and so on. I once met someone who said in his family, they have the rule, they light 8 candles the first night, 7 the second. That's what it's been in his family for generations.
So you knew where he came.
Well, he came from Germany.
No, he came from Beit Shammai.
Well, I'm not quite sure, but anyway. So that's the Rambam's explanation, but there is also which is like a halachic explanation, so that we should understand. The reasoning why the Mishnah includes rejected opinions. The Hasidic explanation takes it to another level. Everything in the Mishnah and in the Talmud is sacred and is teaching us something important. These other opinions, they all have a place in the total scheme of things. It may not be what we actually do in practical action, but they still have some significance. And here is an example. The suggestion that we're talking about a Canaanite slave is one level, and Mikomak, the fact that there is a suggestion in the Talmud, Shu'evet Kanani, that he is a Canaanite slave, Utzichim Limud Miyuchad, we need to learn it from another verse, Talmud Lomar, Lushlol Svarazu, in order to move away from that suggestion. The mizem muvan, and from that we can understand sheyesh makom nomer, that we could possibly say betok salkadaiter as a possibility, the kai gam el eved kanani, that we are also talking about an eved kanani, and so therefore we actually have these different levels, because the eved kanani, the Canaanite slave, hu tchilat avodah, that's the beginning of a service for every Jew, that's the beginning of the relationship with God. And after that we go higher in our service, and we come to the level of the Hebrew slave, till we come to the level of the Hebrew maidservant, which is the highest level, as will be explained. Now, now the subject is, as is explained in previous Hasidic texts at length, Mr. Brackets, The Yesh Gimel Madregot Benefesh Adam. There are three levels in the soul of a person. Eved Knani, a Knanite slave. Eved Ivri, the Hebrew slave. V'oma Ivriya, and the Hebrew maidservant. The Inyanam Hu Gimel Madregot Nefesh Ruach Neshama. Now, we usually talk about the Nefesh HaBahamid, the animal soul, and the Neshama, and the divine soul. But what this is talking about are three levels within the divine soul, and so they are Nefesh, Ruach, Neshama, and these are three levels going deeper and deeper within the divine soul of the person. And these correspond also. So we have the idea that we have a Rasha, and then we have a Beinani, and then we have a Tzaddik. Now, in this sense, a Rasha is a person who sometimes gives in to their evil inclination. And that means basically all of us, or most of us. Because we sometimes lose it. Yes? If we can use a bridge term, the Beinani never misses a trick, and the Rasha sometimes does. Now that sometimes might be once in 2 months or once in 2 minutes. It's a sliding scale. The difference between the Rasha and the Beinani is the Beinani will never miss. He will never miss, or she will never miss, because it's nogeya benefesh. They're totally dedicated and concerned never to miss a trick, even though there may be tremendous temptations. But they withstand the temptation. There's actually a principle that we're never given a temptation too great to withstand. It's an interesting idea. It would rub away, you know, a certain section of world literature. But there is this concept that we are actually always in control, unless in some way we put ourselves in the soup, in a sense, so that we have lost control. But even then, there is the Hasidic teaching is we can always regain control, whatever the situation. We can regain control within ourselves. I mean, we can't. You can't jump onto a roof. You can have self-sacrifice, jump off a roof, but you can't jump from the floor up to the roof. But within our own being, in other words, there are things that are impossible in practical fact, but within our own being we're in control, and that level of being within us. So that's the difference between the Rasha and the Beinani. The Rasha sometimes willingly or unwillingly or seemingly loses control, whereas the Beinani keeps control. And the Tzaddik is on a completely higher level, where it is a transformation. The negative force which the Beinani restrains has been completely transformed for the Tzaddik into a positive force. Alright, so we're now looking at that as the Canaanite slave, the Hebrew slave, and the Hebrew girl, the maidservant. Now this is the order of service. So at the beginning it's a service in the way of the Canaanite slave, and after that the Hebrew slave, and then comes the Hebrew maidservant, as we learn in the Zohar, that at the beginning a person is given the first level of soul. And if he's successful, he goes from level to level, he's given the second level of soul. And then, if he's successful spiritually, he's given the deeper level of soul. That right at the very beginning, a person has the first level of this divine force within them. And so there is the person going from one level to another, higher and higher. Okay. Now,
but in your drawing, Neshama is the highest, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. Neshama is the highest. Now let's try and understand what this means about the Canaanite slave. What is it that makes the Canaanite slave? Now, the point is that a slave, there's a phrase about a slave, avdo behefkeiro nichale, a slave likes doing nothing. A slave is, in this concept, a slave is someone who just likes sitting around and not working. He doesn't want to work. In order to get the slave to work, the slave has to be forced. So you have to force him in one way or the other, and the way that this is translated into this divine service that there is a spiritual input. Actually, I'm not sure if it's here. There's another discourse which talks about this from the Mittler Rebbe, from the second of Amateur Rebbe, which says that what forces the slave are like spiritual insights which push, there are spiritual forces which push the person. Because this slave, incidentally, it's a Canaanite slave, but it's owned by a Hebrew. Who's the Hebrew? Abraham. Abraham was the first Hebrew. Avraham or Ivri. Abraham the Hebrew. We all have an inheritance from Abraham. So even if we're just at the level of the Canaanite slave, we have an inbuilt love of God which comes from Abraham. And if that love of God is suddenly triggered off, it pushes us in a positive direction. So we in ourselves, we might like to just sit doing nothing as far as Judaism goes, as far as connection with God, as far as doing anything spiritual goes. You know, we're very much into, both material and other kinds of pleasure. But the spiritual connection that the Torah gives us with God, a person might say, leave me alone. I don't want to be dragged in that direction. I'm okay as I am. Thanks very much. That's okay. Leave me alone. And then suddenly the person can be overtaken with a tremendous feeling of holiness, of spirituality against themselves. I remember once, many, many years ago, I was on a ship which sailed from Marseille to Haifa. And on the ship, I had got to know a Jewish academic who had been, I think, an Austrian Jew, and he was now, this is going back a long time, but he was then an academic, I think, in LSE, London School of Economics. And there were also some families of Moroccan immigrants who were going to Israel. And so at dawn, suddenly, the ship is approaching Haifa. Now, Haifa is a very, very beautiful city to approach from the sea. And the dawn was just rising, and it looked, which means you're looking east. It was extremely beautiful sight, and everyone began weeping, except the academic from the LSE, so the Moroccan families are weeping. I'm weeping, and he's saying to me, "It means nothing to me."
Poor fellow.
It means nothing to me. Yeah, so I don't know. He might have become, by now he might be a rabbi.
No, somewhere. The Jewish voices with this new little ill JLV.
Well, I don't know. He might be a rabbi living in Jerusalem.
He's a rabbi. I mean,
maybe. Learning, teaching mysticism. Who knows? But the point is, we get confronted by spiritual urges, and we suddenly we're sort of forced to recognize the spiritual. And if we try to live a little bit consistently, that might lead to all kinds of changes in us.
He must have had Asperger's.
So that's the point, that at this lowest level, the Canaanite slave, so this Canaanite, the only way one can get him to do anything is by a real push. He has to be inspired from some kind of unexpected inspiration. The Six-Day War. I mean, the Six-Day War was the most incredible experience for the Jewish people. In a phenomenal, phenomenal way. And I was in Israel not very long after that, visiting, and it was the most incredible thing.
I was a narrow-minded, I was a universalist, humanist, blah blah, etc., with no time for narrow-minded nationalism, which included Zionism.
Well,
it took me about 2 minutes to wake up.
2 minutes.
Something like that. I was so horrified.
Yeah, I had this friend. He he was a school friend. Very, very anti-Jewish identity, anti-Israel, very left-wing, completely negative. And living with a non-Jewish girl. So came the Six-Day War. So I phoned him up to see what he thought about it. So his non-Jewish girlfriend said, "Oh, he's gone off to fight for Israel." In fact, he didn't fight. He picked oranges, but he was doing something useful.
Sure. The war was over by the time he knew what's going
on. All right, so there you have the level of the Canaanite slave, where there has to be this sort of revelation from above, which, because the Canaanite slave belongs to Abraham the Hebrew. So we can't get away from that. We're not just a Canaanite slave. We're the Canaanite who belongs to Abraham. We've got a spark of this love of God hidden within us. Then we come...
Why is it not happening now, sorry? The Six-Day War effect. Why is it having the opposite effect now? For the disaffected Jews. There's just so many of them. I mean, the threat is even greater than the Six-Day War.
It's interesting what had, you know, all the different levels of effect of the Six-Day War. There was the threat, and there was the success, and there was the capture of the temple, and the West Wall,
and
Jerusalem.
And there's now this attempt to give everything back and put us under even worse danger than then.
You're right.
Something strange has happened.
So it means we have to work very hard at communicating the inspiration of Torah and of Judaism and of Jewish life.
Well, this is true, but and that's within Israel it's very difficult.
Well, the spiritual package that was there in Israel is still there for many people.
Yeah.
And it's a very powerful message. But at the same time, as much as you have positive things, you also have negative things, and free will remains in an astonishing way.
Okay, good.
So then we have the Hebrew slave. Who is someone who is on a deeper level. Now I'm going to move into another image, which is in the Mittlerer Rebbe. in a book called Torah Chaim, which is on the Sedra, on the Sefer, the book of Shemot, the book of Exodus. And there is a teaching which is quoted here about these three kinds of servant, and we'll finish on that note. We've gone beyond the Canaanite slave. Okay, so we're now the Hebrew slave and the maidservant. What's the difference between the Hebrew slave and the maidservant? The Hebrew slave goes out to the market. The maidservant stays at home. She is involved at home, she's cooking, she's doing things in the home. And the Hebrew slave, the lower level, he goes out to the market. He goes out to the market, he's there confronted with all kinds of negative things possibly, which he has to try to avoid. And he buys things which are going to be brought back home and are then going to be cooked and made into something edible, but you have to work at it. So he is going out into a world of negativity, certain levels of negativity, but he's going to take the right things, he's going to bring the kosher food, as it were, he's going to bring the right thing home. And that is the level of service of a person who, let's say in study of Torah, you're studying Torah, but you're studying a page of Talmud which might be talking about all kinds of negative things or very, very material things. But in fact, it's Torah. It's Torah. For example, what happens when you're studying that part of Torah which speaks about a swindler and what the swindler has in mind when he swindles? You know, you've almost got to enter into the mind of the swindler in order to argue this way and that way what he means and how we should deal with him. So it's Torah, but it's going out into the marketplace. You know, when we are taking that and we are looking at it from a Torah point of view, but we're in a sense getting our hands dirty, or seemingly, even though we're actually studying it in the Beit HaMedrash. But then he comes back in and he brings all this to the maidservant who is there in the house. And she's on a different level. She's only dealing with the things which are edible and can be cooked, and it's just a matter of putting it on the heat for the right time and adding water and stirring it and so on and laying the tablecloth and putting it out. She's in a much more spiritual world. And so for her, we're really talking about a more spiritual dimension, like someone who is studying spiritual teachings. It's not the Torah which is dealing with the practicalities of the world. It's spiritual teachings which are able to elevate the soul in a very direct way and connect them straight to Hashem.
The mitzvah of eating anyway.
Yes, except that here we're
making it palatable to be eaten, to be raised to the higher.
All right, that's a spiritual perspective on a practical thing, but this is really an image for something which is a purely spiritual process. That when one is dealing just with things which are immediate, which are edible, and one doesn't have the problem of being in the marketplace. That's like the way that I understand this text is that it's talking about exploring spiritual teachings, the tree of life, the inner dimension of the Torah, Hasidic teachings. And entering into that, it is all about radiance and the divine and the soul. It's talking about spiritual quantities. Whereas if you're learning, they're beautiful, they're fascinating, Bava Basra, Bava Matsya, you're talking a house and a courtyard and two shutafim, two partners who share the courtyard, and they want to divide the courtyard, should they make a wall, not make a wall. So you're talking about the practicalities of life, which is like the middle level. Whereas when you come inwards, you are there talking at this more spiritual dimension. Now, it's quite true that the inner spiritual dimension enables you to recognize in the outer world and in the marketplace and in the fields and the mountains and the desert that everything is holy, that there is godliness in everything. So we go inwards, as it were, into the spiritual dimension beyond, and then we're able to flow outwards as well and recognize the oneness which is in everything. However, at the beginning of learning Torah, we recognize that with our Sedra, that first of all, there's the whole process of learning Torah, and the way in which Moshe and Moshe Rabbeinu, through the generations, in each generation, there's a Moshe. who gives over the Torah to us in such a way that we're able to internalize it, lifnehem, lipnimiyutam, to our inwardness, that we in hafnama, that we internalize it. And then is our response to the Torah, and we respond to the Torah as a Canaanite slave, as a Hebrew slave, or as the Hebrew maidservant, being close to God, marrying the master. That's what the Hebrew maidservant does. And that's what we do. We connect with God. Yechida, the only one. You see, Yechida is the deepest, deepest level of the soul. And it's in the feminine. In fact, Neshama is also in the feminine, and then the next level is Chaya, and then Yechida. These are words in the feminine. And it's each person's soul, whether they are male or a female. And that Yechida, that only one within us, connects with Yachid, the only one who is the infinite divine. And that is the bond between us. That's right. Okay. And so there is this unity between us and God. So our Sedra. So our Sedra is giving us an introduction into these levels of service of God.
Very exciting.